Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, pledging to help end child hunger in the Carolinas through ongoing support of Second Harvest Food Bank of Metrolina. Details about this initiative at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, 16 Mecklenburg County employees, along with 100 workers at Novant Health, lose their jobs for not complying with COVID-19 requirements. A federal judge suspends South Carolina's school mask ban. That state's governor vows to fight it all the way to the Supreme Court. Mecklenburg County scrambles to find housing for former Tent City residents as money for hotel stays runs out. That as Charlotte allocates $23 million for affordable housing. State budget talks are underway. Governor Cooper vetoes another bill that would take power from the executive branch and transfer it to the legislature. And Mick Jagger comes to town. Here to bring us up to date on those stories and more is WFAE's education reporter Ann Doss Helms. Welcome back. Good to see you.
Good morning.
Jonathan Lowe is here. He's a reporter anchor for Spectrum News One. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Mike. Good to see you.
Nick Oxner is WBTV's executive producer for investigations and Channel 3's chief investigative reporter. He came to us live while moving in a WBTV van, obviously driving to your side.
Good morning, Mike.
Good morning. And Eric Spanberg is managing editor. That tickles me. I don't know why. Managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal.
Well, me
good
too.
Morning. Yes.
Good morning.
Good morning. Since February, when a tent city on the edge of uptown was shut down by Mecklenburg County as a health hazard, a lot of former residents there have been housed in hotels at the county's expense. The money ran out on Thursday. Karen Pelletier, the director of housing innovation and strategy for the county, told WCNC TV that everyone will have a place to go, but the need is greater than just those from the tent city. The county estimates more than 3,100 people are homeless in the county today.
We need affordable, permanent housing. I don't think we're turning our back on any possible permanent affordable housing opportunity, and that includes the purchase of hotels.
So the money ran out for the people in those hotels on, I think, Wednesday or Thursday. What has happened to those folks in the interim? Jonathan.
So they have been moved basically through the organizations.
Oops. Okay, so we're having a problem with Jonathan's internet connection. Anybody have an answer to that question?
They have been moved to other hotels. I think there are about 58 people out of more than 200 who were originally relocated, and they're looking at hotels as the solution for the immediate future.
And so, this is an effort by three different groups, including the Roof Above, Block Love Charlotte, and Catholic Charities, that is helping to arrange these hotels. Down to 58 from about 200 initially, or 300
initial people. Go ahead, Jonathan, you're back. Go ahead.
Sorry, I just had a little bit of an internet issue there. About 215 people. And one of the organizations that throughout this process, and it's always been known, Mike, that the county was, this was just going to be a temporary fix as far as people from Tent City going to hotels. And so they've been working with organizations like Catholic Charities to relocate people to hotels. And that's actually going to continue even after with the remaining people that are still at the current hotels.
So initially, housing was provided for these folks for 90 days. Then it was extended through September 30th, which was yesterday. And it isn't just housing that these folks have been given. Bethany McDonald, who's the program's director at Hearts Beat as One, a nonprofit that helps at-risk communities, has been working nonstop with these residents with medical and mental health treatments.
If we had one person get out of a tent and into permanent housing, it would be an incredible success. Knowing that so many people got the treatment and got the opportunities they deserve, it's just it's overwhelming.
Meanwhile, Charlotte City Council voted to allocate over $23 million from the Housing Trust Fund to 9 developments that will bring 879 units of affordable housing to the city. We often talk about how difficult it seems to be to get developers to bring to the market any kind of affordable housing. But over the summer, 11 applicants applied to the city and 9 are going to get this money. Who are these successful applicants and what kinds of housing will this be?
So, Jonathan. Mike, this is going to be a variety. This is kind of what the city council has said. Some of them on city council have said this is innovative because it includes new construction, as well as what the city calls NOAAs, naturally occurring affordable housing opportunities. So you will see rental opportunities within these 9 projects. You also see rental opportunities. Of course, with this being affordable housing, there will be deed restrictions that will go on for decades to ensure that it remains affordable and that people can stay in place and live in a decent, affordable place.
879 units may not be enough to house every homeless person in Charlotte, but it seems like a significant number. And given the fact that we talk repeatedly about how difficult it is to get developers, particularly people who are building new construction, to include affordable housing units in their new construction, how did they pull this off? Why were these people even interested?
Well, you've always had people that are developers that are, you know, willing to an extent to build affordable housing with, you know, this federal and city money available. So that is not unprecedented. One of the things that you're seeing happen here, though, Mike, is this group LISC, Local Initiative Support Corporation, which was brought in by the city. Remember, they worked with the private sector and the Foundation for the Carolinas. You've got sort of a three-pronged attack. And so they're able to more effectively spend the money because you're not just using that federal money, which is very limited, that Charlotte receives to build housing. And then the second part Jonathan referred to, which is this naturally occurring affordable housing, which is hard for me to say. More emphasis on that certainly makes sense in every way because it's cheaper, and so you can do more of it. And so what you're seeing is a realization of this strategy that was born several years ago when the mayor and the private sector agreed to raise $50 million in matching funds for affordable housing.
Charlotte City Councilwoman Dimple Ashmira called this a drop in the bucket, but a step in the right direction. This money, as we said, comes from the Housing Trust Fund, which was given $210 million between 2002 and 2020. With this latest investment, they now have just under $9.5 million left in that fund. Does this money come from the housing bonds, affordable housing bonds that we passed? And will we likely see that fund replenished, Jonathan?
So the mayor was actually asked about this yesterday, Mike, and it was discussed in the city council meeting earlier this week. What will the city do next? And basically the mayor said she's confident that voters in Charlotte see the benefit of programs like LISC and this housing trust fund and the bond, which voters will have to decide on again whether they want to support. But she says she's confident that that will happen. And so there's certainly an appetite on a majority of the council that want to continue with this type of project.
Mike, you're absolutely right. You know, this is, or I guess Councilwoman Ashmira is right. It's a drop in the bucket. This is an overwhelming problem. The city said, what, there are 55,000 people that don't have affordable housing. Generally, you want to spend no more than a third of your income on rent or mortgage. But it's also worth noting that of the 215 people in the tent city, 100 have already been moved into permanent housing. That's pretty impressive. It's very difficult to transition homeless people into permanent housing. So that's obviously they're nowhere near done, but that's a pretty good batting average on that specific case.
And one thing you'll probably, go ahead. I was just going to add really quickly. If you ride around Charlotte, you'll see, especially in some of the lower socioeconomic neighborhoods, you'll see a lot of new construction. And, you know, you just do the math and you kind of do a little research and you figure.
Okay, we've lost him again. This does not bode well. I'm hoping that's your Wi-Fi and not Spectrum. Let's move on to a different topic here. We haven't talked about anything about COVID yet, so that's a record, it seems, because we usually open up with this. On the macro level, people have been concerned about economic recovery because of people not getting the vaccinations, slowing things down. But on the micro level, some businesses are taking matters into their own hands. United Airlines is in the news this week because it has mandated its employees get the vaccine. And this week, Mecklenburg County and Novant Health both followed through on their promise to release employees who refused to comply with their COVID-19 mandates. The county released 16 employees. Novant let more than 100 people go. The county suspended 350 employees in mid-September and set up a deadline for those people to comply. What were they being asked to do that the 16 who were fired did not do?
They were being asked to either be vaccinated or be tested weekly. Obviously to show that they did not have COVID-19. And you're right, Mike, that we're seeing this across the country and here. But I think one of the big takeaways, we're talking about these numbers and who was let go. But one of the big takeaways is how effective this mandate for vaccines has been. I mean, you talk about the Novant case, 99% of their 35,000 employees are vaccinated. So I think what we're seeing is that mandates work. They're very effective. And we're going to have, you know, some unsettled moments with people who are holdouts. But overall, the vast majority of people who are told by their employers to go get a shot are going to get a shot.
Mm-hmm. And the situation, I think, is a little different at Novant, where they released, I think, they suspended 375 employees last week, gave them 5 days to get into compliance with the hospital system's COVID policies. And then they fired more than 100 people. What are their policies?
They have a vaccine mandate. The hospitals have vaccine mandates. So unless you have the medical or religious exemption, you have to get the shot. And both systems have had different time frames for when you have to meet that mandate. But it's pretty simple. You know, you're either getting the shot or you're not, or you have the exemption or you're leaving.
So it seems to be effective when it comes from your employer who provides you your paycheck. There are also mask mandates coming and going up and down, depending upon what court system you're in, it seems. South Carolina has forbidden schools to require masks to be worn in classroom, but parents of disabled children, assisted by the American Civil Liberties Union, sued the state. And this week, a federal judge suspended South Carolina from enforcing their ban. Anne, was that a surprise?
At least the ACLU would say no. They said it was a very clear-cut case, that it was comparable to saying you can't build ramps for disabled kids, that if masks are optional, you will have a large number of people going unmasked in schools. A lot of the young people are unvaccinated and are not even eligible for vaccines. So this isn't just if you have a learning disability. This is medical conditions, respiratory conditions, immunocompromised kids. And if you go into that setting, that becomes a life-threatening situation. So that was their argument, and the judge believed that it was a good one.
Yep. In her ruling, U.S. District Judge Mary Geiger-Lewis wrote, "It is non-controversial that children need to go to school and they are entitled to any reasonable accommodation that allows them to do so. No one can reasonably argue that it is an undue burden to wear a mask to accommodate a child with disabilities." But that does not mean that South Carolina Governor Henry McMaster won't argue that.
I disagree 100% with the opinion of the district judge, and we will take it to the U.S. Supreme Court if necessary.
That's the governor speaking with WBTV. Will that be necessary to overturn that ruling, going to the Supreme Court?
Well, there's an appeals court one step between them, but yes, it seems like this could be a thing that's headed to the court.
Well, we have more to talk about with regard to masks in South Carolina and masks in certain North Carolina districts. And it seems that we have two judges on opposite sides of the same coin. We'll talk about that as well and more when we come back with our local news roundup. Ann Doss Helms, Jonathan Lowe, Eric Spanberg, and Nick Oxner here on Charlotte Talks. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks and the listener news, the local news roundup on listener supported 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Ann Doss Helms is our education reporter. She is with us this morning. Jonathan Lowe, anchor reporter for Spectrum News One, also here. Nick Oxner is in a car somewhere, for WBTV. And Eric Spanberg is here. He's the managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. So, Ann, we just heard from South Carolina Governor Henry McMaster, who says he will take this judge's decision that they cannot enforce their mask ban in schools in the Palmetto State. He will take it all the way to the Supreme Court. And he's not the only person disagreeing with the court's decision. Courtney Green from Lancaster Parents for Choice is also opposed. She told WBTV,
"We're fighting for our children to be in schools with the choices that their parents make and not the choices that some government official or some judge makes. My freedoms are being taken away again. My children's freedoms are being taken away again."
That statement in the same week that a 7-year-old first grader at CMS died from COVID, and just a month after a 16-year-old Lancaster County student died from COVID. Nick, WBTV reported that although South Carolina State Superintendent of Education Molly Spearman says school districts now have the discretionary authority to require masks, how quickly may they have to act?
Well, this the guidance here has been handed down now from the court that you don't have to abide by this ban on mask mandates. And so that clears the way to take action as you see fit.
And we should note that some South Carolina districts have mandated masks in defiance of the state rule, the state law. So I think there will be some that will jump on this pretty quickly.
So this ban was put into effect in June by the Palmetto State's Republican-controlled legislature. At the time, they were averaging about 150 new COVID cases today, and soon thereafter, the Delta variant caused some dramatic spikes. Well over 21,000 students have been infected, and nearly 100,000 in South Carolina had to quarantine. And several school districts had asked the legislature to go back into session and change that rule. Do they need to do that now that the court has ruled?
No, you wouldn't need to because the court has struck that rule down. Now, if they wanted to make it cleaner, they could roll that back and then there would dry up your court fight. But as we just heard from Governor McMaster before the break, it doesn't sound like that's the option that South Carolina Republicans want to take. And so it sounds like we'll continue this fight in court while in the meantime, districts will have the freedom to implement the rules as they see fit.
So this mask situation is causing all kinds of problems all across the country. North Carolina officials say that threats, insults, even violence are proving increasingly disruptive at school board meetings around the state. And all of this, Ann, is over masks?
Masks seems to be one of the big triggers. Sometimes critical race theory, there's sort of, you know, those two are have become sort of merged among a certain segment that believe that they need to fight for freedom from the government entity that is providing their children's education. So, and again, there is vigorous debate over masks and quarantines, as there should be. This is an evolving situation. There's legitimate debate. Most of the public comment periods that I have streamed or watched are intense but orderly, but some people are, you know, shouting down board members. There was a destruction of property incident at Iredell Statesville Schools where people literally banged on a door when they couldn't get into the chamber. There are threats that are either being stated in public meetings or emailed or posted. So it's just become a really, a lot of people are saying, a really toxic and disruptive environment.
Well, Eric Davis, who used to be the head of our local school board here in Mecklenburg County, is now chairing the state Board of Education, and he says, as in so many areas of our lives in the Trump era, things are getting out of hand.
It's actions and threats that go beyond the substance of the disagreement and go to personal attacks and threats upon the safety of those who've volunteered to serve on local boards of education.
Marianne Wolf, who is the president of the Raleigh-based Public School Forum of North Carolina, says that this is happening all around the state.
Whether it's protest, whether it's outright threats given during public comment, whether it's threatening emails that are being sent. And, you know, we continue to hear that our elected officials, our district leaders are afraid for their safety, but also for the safety of those in their district.
And as you just mentioned, at a meeting of the Idle States full board, someone tried to break down a door to a board meeting, and board chair Martin Page says he sees this as part of a national trend.
I think the anti-government movement nationwide has just gotten out of hand. And I mean, school boards are low-hanging fruit, so I think they're, you know, coming to our meetings and trying to cause trouble.
Idle Statesville will be bringing in extra security for future meetings, and that will cost money. But Martin Page says the real cost is much higher.
When you don't want to bring the students in that you want to recognize, and the teachers that you want to recognize because they're scared for their well-being, there's something wrong with that. That's not America that I know and love.
This is pernicious, and he's correct. It's un-American. It's a good thing for parents to be interested in their child's education and have strong opinions on it. It's another thing to threaten elected officials. And since all politics is local, this really is very local in all these places that it is happening. But they're using the anger that's being driven by, I think, social media and Fox News and other people who are against the federal government.
I was going to say, Mike, it's all politics is national. That's how so many of these things boil down. I mean, you introduced this story with the Trump era. And I think even though it may not be about Trump, and sometimes it is, it's that general attitude, that general, lack of decorum. I think Governor Cooper said something to the effect of our children are watching these meetings. Let's maybe model a little bit better behavior. But when you see that, it reminds me of the airport and airplanes. We're seeing this across society, and without sounding too alarmist, this is just getting out of hand. People have to act better. We can't have extra security in every single facet of our lives. We're going to have to learn some self-discipline.
And
I did want to point out of fairness to Eric Davis, who is in a very political position where he tries very hard to be nonpartisan, he did not put that quote into the context of Donald Trump. He is concerned about what's going on, but he did not link it to a particular ex-president party.
I'll take the fall for that.
Yes,
I did. Because
I just
want to
make that clear
that.
Because I think you said he said it.
And Trump simply tapped into anger that was already out there and used it to his advantage. But when your top leaders, and I think you can make the argument that the president is the top leader of the nation, when they give you permission to act like a spoiled brat, then you will do so. There's a state law that requires school boards to revisit their masking policies monthly. And this week, Republicans in the legislature turned back efforts to repeal that law. So can we assume then that this bad behavior will continue as long as these boards are forced to hold these meetings once a month and talk about what their masking policy will continue to be?
Well, I'm not convinced that it would have ended if they'd changed this. I mean, the once a month is bizarre on a lot of levels. I don't know why the state legislature is dictating local school board agendas. Everybody would be revisiting this anyway, as situations require. But I think that there's this momentum, and people are showing up whenever there's a public comment period. It doesn't matter what's on the agenda. They're showing up to address these same issues repeatedly.
Nick, did you want to chime in on that?
Yeah, I'll just echo what Ann said. I mean, it's not like they're holding special school board meetings just to talk about the masking. It's just a thing they're talking about. And as someone who's new to paying attention to CMS board meetings in the last few months, I can say people were showing up to talk about masking for the race theory, whether it was on the agenda or not, to Ann's point. I think the General Assembly in North Carolina did this once a month deal as somewhat of a compromise between some more conservative members who wanted a ban on masking and, you know, people who wanted to either give local control or to have masking in schools. And so they said, fine, you can do it if you want, but you need to think about it every month.
And I would just say, actually, they are holding emergency meetings on masks when they see numbers that make them go, wow, we wanted to do mask optional. Oh, this is not working well for us. We're having lots of cases. They will call an emergency meeting. So again, nobody's just going to sit around and wait for permission. And the mask mandatory districts, which are the overwhelming majority in North Carolina, nobody's just going to say, I want to do this all year because it's kind of fun. If we start to see those numbers come down and medical advice is, you know, we don't need to worry about the mask, I think there'll be standing in line to get rid of their mandates.
So we have the district judge, the U.S. district judge in South Carolina, knocking down that state's ban on masks. Meanwhile, in North Carolina, a judge ruled yesterday on Lincoln County School's mask optional policy. Evidently, some parents in that area took them to court through the ACLU. I think it was the ACLU. I could be wrong about that. They lost. Anne?
They did. They wanted an injunction saying that Lincoln County could not do a mask optional policy. The state legislature has, unlike South Carolina, which said school boards cannot take this one option, North Carolina said it's up to the school boards. And Lincoln County opened with optional, went to mandatory, and now has said we're going to go back and try optional. And the judge said that's within what the state has allowed, and that you can go ahead with that for now.
And to be fair, yesterday's ruling was a judge just denying an emergency restraining order against the mask optional policy. So this isn't a final decision in the Lincoln County case. It's actually a pretty early preliminary decision that comes with different criteria. And so, that's not the final word. Unlike the district court, the federal district court in South Carolina, which is a lot more permanent final decision.
So like so many of these cases, we seem to have school boards in opposition to the county school boards in opposition to the county health department. And in Lincoln County, the health director there, David Madden, said currently Lincoln County has seen a significant increase in positive cases among young people 17 and under. So I was just curious. Well, I was going to ask why this decision now, why to keep it optional, but I think we have an answer to that question. It's politics. But in Union County, they have come to an agreement. A memorandum of understanding was issued with the county's health department and the school board there over how to handle contact tracing and quarantine protocols. What is that memo of understanding outline?
Well, basically, this goes back to, Union County is by far the largest district that has consistently said masks are optional, mm-hmm. Above strenuous protests from some of their teachers and parents. And that led to a very high number of quarantines, because that's how the state rules go. If you are wearing masks consistently, far fewer kids have to go home. And they said, well, we don't want our kids to go home. We don't want them to have to wear masks. So we're just bringing them all back. And we're going to say, if you want to quarantine somebody, health department, have at it. It's not our business. We wash our hands of that. And that created quite a lot of furor at the state and local level. So now they're essentially saying, okay, we're going to cooperate. If whoever finds out, health department or schools, whoever finds out about a case among an employee or a student is going to notify the other one. The school district will now take responsibility for saying, okay, we're going to let you know who was in a class, who was, potentially in close contact. But then the actual responsibility for declaring a quarantine and issuing the quarantine orders will fall to the health department. And, again, just a sign of the times, they had to include detailed instructions saying that the school district will honor that, as opposed to just saying, come on in, because so many signals have been sent that we really don't think you ought to be staying home, that, this is going to families who really believe that their kids ought to be in school, regardless of masks, regardless of vaccinations.
So it only took 3 weeks of fighting and the threat of legal action by the head of the state health and human services department for a school district and a county health department to agree that they should share information about a deadly pandemic. I mean, that's incredible.
I was just sitting here thinking that I've been doing this a long time, and so have you, Eric, and so have you, Nick, and Jonathan, and Anne. I've never seen anything like this with anything before. We're heading into uncharted territory. I don't know that it's going, and not just with this issue, but with everything. I'm not sure it's going to end very well. But moving on, even WBTV has been looking at sexual allegations of sexual impropriety, rape, and other sexual assaults at Myers Park High School. And Nick, you reported this week on a task force formed by CMS to evaluate how the district handles reports of sexual violence. Who is on the task force?
Well, we don't know, and I'm not being glib. CMS Superintendent Ernest Winston announced this task force response.
And of course, when I come to you, of course, we're having internet problems. You're the only person that knows the answer to this question, and you have now frozen on my screen. Let's try it again.
And Nick has pursued it vigorously also. They did announce that there would be a meeting. I think probably both of us said, great, when is it, where is it? We're going to let people know we're potentially going to cover it. They said, oh, it's not an open meeting. It is an advisory board to the superintendent as opposed to an advisory board to the school board. So they are claiming, and they did release a few of the members who are employees. They said there are 10 students. They have not named them. And they have said, you don't get to come to the meetings, but we will release support afterward. I hope that Nick is maybe getting better connections.
Yeah, and there are some people on this board, on this task force, who are allegedly experts in this field. Why would they not tell you who the experts are?
They won't even tell us the community organization that these experts are from. So again, you have a thing that's announced in response, in theory, to address a major uproar and problem identified in the community. It's operating totally in secret. We only know three of the 17 people that are on this task force, and lawyers for WBTV told Charlotte Mecklenburg Schools that they think this is violating the state open meetings law. And General Counsel Andre Mays has said she disagrees, but can't outline any specific statutory language that supports her position.
I was going to ask you, does this violate the law? Because we have these public meetings cannot be private, and these are public meetings, essentially. Why
CMS
is there even
is
a
saying
question
they're
about
not.
That?
For instance, if the superintendent formed a staff committee, staff only, to discuss something, clearly that would not be. This gets murkier because it is, as Nick pointed out, it includes not just employees, but students and outside members. At the very least, and I sort of get their argument that they want students to be able to talk openly, but they're creating a real perception of not trying. And Nick, you've got a good connection, right?
Yes, sorry. So the definition of a public meeting in North Carolina has to be two or more people and has to be created by a government entity, including a local school entity, and for among the things for the purpose of giving advice. So here that meets all three prongs of a definition of a public body.
Do we have any granular detail on how they're going to evaluate their policy? And I have 20 seconds.
We have granular nothing.
Granular nothing is what you said. I should point out that Nick Oxner from WBTV is in a moving vehicle this morning, and that is part of the problem here. Jonathan Lowe is back with us. We have reestablished life on Mars with him. He'll come back in the next segment along with Ann Doss Helms and Eric Spanberg. It's the local news roundup on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. Hey, Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We'll stick with schools for a little more of our program here today, and then we'll move on to other topics. But the CMS School Board unanimously approved a new social media policy this week that spells out what's appropriate for the district's official accounts and for their 19,000 employees and what they can post on their personal accounts. What brought this about?
Well, I believe it was just part of sort of a policy review. And to be clear, soon after social media emerged, we probably all did stories about somebody in public employment and or private employment who posted something that created a lot of controversy, and there's always been the chance that you could lose your job or be disciplined over this. So what they're saying is we're trying to spell some things out and make it clear. First of all, you know, your personal account is part of your job persona. You will be held accountable. They've laid out some things that would seem pretty obvious, that you can't post things that are hate-filled or racist or vulgar or obscene. And it's also things like, you could be held accountable if you disrupt the school learning environment or the school environment. So it really poses as many questions as it answers. You know, we have just been talking about all the ways that two groups of people can have very different ideas about what's hateful or what's racist. And, you know, disrupting the environment could mean that if you post something and another group really, you know, creates an uproar over it, you know, does stages protests, whatever, you could be held accountable for that. So it's
CMS is also,
it's probably a good step, but it's, you know, it's not going to solve everything.
CMS is also crafting a new plan for student success and setting goals and strategies for reading and language arts, which saw evidently major setbacks during last year's period of online-only education. And you reported, Anne, that the district is, quote, dramatically off track for the six-year goals they hope to meet by 2024. How dramatically?
Oh, and I do not have that article in front of me to read from the charts, but it is, you know, the idea was you had this six-year plan where you would start from a fairly low percentage at college and career ready and move up to, you know, close to 85-90% for the groups that were further behind. They had to climb a little faster. In fact, what happened was slow progress, pandemic, dive. So they're very low percentages now for some of these groups. So I think the likelihood that they can miraculously recover in 2 years is virtually none.
So if they're blaming online education for these dramatically lower scores and grades, I suppose, why did the school board also this week vote unanimously to expand virtual learning options to include younger students who will now have the option to enroll?
Because this is not, during the pandemic, you saw people forced en masse to go into online. And I think everybody would agree that it's not the best thing for all students, but it is good for some students. So this is, CMS had opened it up to grades 3 through 12, but not K-2, because they said those kids really need the face-to-face. But again, we talked about kids with medical, fragile, you know, immune systems, things like that. What they've said is we will create options for those young children. If it's really physically dangerous for them to be out and about, we will let them do an online learning.
Well, Eric, this week, Atrium Health made a presentation to the county commission in which they asked for $75 million tax dollars to help build the medical school in what they are calling the innovation district that will surround it. And yesterday, Charlotte Mayor Vi Lyle said the benefits this will provide are more than sufficient to justify the ask. How would the city and the county contributions to this be divided up?
So this is a pretty standard request in terms of economic development from local government. And the way it works is you take a portion of the additional property tax revenue that's generated over some amount of time, 10, 20 years, and you funnel some of that into paying for or paying back the expense of road improvements, water improvements, sewer, any kind of infrastructure that is needed to develop this project. I think it's about a 20-acre site in Midtown. So the idea is that just based on the way taxes work, about two-thirds of it, $50 million, would come from the county and $25 million would come from the city.
Jonathan, Atrium says the medical school and the surrounding innovation district would add about 5,500 jobs, generating $514 million over 15 years, with 30 to 40% of those jobs open to people without college degrees. Can we safely assume that the county and the city are going to kick in the $75 million given those figures?
It certainly sounded like it. You know, if you listened in to the county commission meeting, most of them were on board with this idea. Didn't sound like they were scoffing at the idea of spending $75 million or splitting $75 million. We have not heard this came out after city council met this week. So the only person we've heard from so far would be Mayor Lyles. So it will be interesting to see what we hear from city council, because they're looking to move rather quick on this. We're talking 2024. So I would assume that this will be coming up with city council pretty soon here.
You can't fault them for asking for the $75 million, but Atrium Health, I think, is the largest employer in the Charlotte region, and they are tax-free exempt. I don't think they pay property taxes. They are a nonprofit. They pay big, 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 big salaries to their CEO and to their other high-dollar earners up there. Why do they need the money?
Well, and I should credit Lisa Wharf from WFAE asked that question of the mayor during the press briefing yesterday. And the mayor's answer was that this is about the economic value that this project will bring, that this will transform the economy. This will bring in not only high paying jobs, but high knowledge jobs, research and development. And she says that this should be considered like any other economic development project, which there is a precedence for doing this. But my sense of the answer was it may have touched a nerve.
But they're going to do it no matter what. They're going to build this medical school mm-hmm. no matter what. It's not like the Panthers who have an option to move to Rock Hill. They're going to do this. So why do they need the money? And why is City Council open to it?
And Mike, if I can just add real quick, this is already kind of underway. If you know where they're talking about, it's right. over by Pearl Street Park. Right. They've already started with kind of preparing that site for something bigger. So.
Well, and I don't think, let me just be two things. First is, while Atrium Health is a nonprofit, there will be, I mentioned the property tax, there are private investments on that land, which is how you get the property tax revenue to repay it. And the second thing, though, is, I guess, to your point and Jonathan's, is they're not threatening not to do anything if they don't get this money. I think that the argument that's being made is this is a legitimate use of public money. So will you do this?
Okay. CMPD is considering a pilot program of 2-person teams that they would send out to respond to certain 911 calls, a mental health clinician and an emergency medical technician. It's part of the city's Safe Charlotte initiative. How would they decide, Jonathan, when to send police versus these new 2-person teams that are not CMPD?
So this is all based on the idea of using 911 calls, basically, and people. At least that's the range doing this.
Well, I'm sorry to say once again, you need to call your service provider and get better Wi-Fi, because it's not working, Jonathan. I'm moving on. The NCAA recently granted college athletes the ability to be paid for their name, image, and likeness. That decision was well received by the athletes and some in the sports world. But this suggestion may not be. It comes from one of our two former college athletes who are serving in the United States Senate. That person would be North Carolina Republican Richard Burr. He's promised to introduce legislation that would tax these athletes. Burr says if a student chooses to monetize their name, image, and likeness, in some cases earning them $1 million or more a year, their scholarship should be subject to federal income taxation. In a way, does this reverse advances pushed forward by the NCAA rule change? Nick?
I don't know that it reverses advances. What it does is start taxing some of the benefits that Senator Burr would argue athletes get as income. And so it treats all of their scholarship, in addition to the name and image likeness proceeds, as income. And so it's certainly a change, and it certainly is taking away some money from what is currently not taxed. But, you know, people like Senator Burr would argue this is just, you know, if you're making money, you should, you know, be taxed on your benefits.
He says it's critical that we help protect successful collegiate sports model that has provided students with education and professional opportunities for more than a century. And this would tax athletes who make more than $20,000 from their name, image, or likeness going forward. All of this is enough to drive a person to drink, I suppose. But you really can't, because there's a liquor shortage, evidently, that you've looked into, Nick. North Carolina faces a liquor shortage. We've been hearing about this for a while, and you've been looking into why. WBTV uncovered some problems with the distribution of liquor that got worse when a new contract was implemented this summer. What's going on here?
When you tell me liquor shortage, I am right there, Mike, to investigate deeply.
On your side.
I'm on your side. That's right. There are some legitimate supply chain problems, mostly owing to the pandemic, right? There's a shortage of glass, problem growing the agave plant for tequila, some things like that that have caused a little bit of tightening of liquor supply. But in North Carolina, there's also an issue with our distributor. And all across the state, ABC stores are missing shipments. They're having trouble ordering liquor That's including here in Mecklenburg County. If you walk into most ABC stores, you're going to find lots of empty shelves. And these problems got worse when the distributor that holds one company holds the contract to warehouse and ship liquor across the entire state with the ABC Commission moved to a new electronic ordering and distribution system. And that has led to the increase in problems that we found. Of course, everyone thinks this, including the ABC Commission, except for the distribution company.
So the ABC commissioner resigned days before your investigation without giving a reason for his departure. Was it connected to distribution problems or was it connected to your investigation?
Well, our investigation into distribution problems, he resigned on a Friday or he'd already been asking questions. So you can, I don't know for sure, but certainly the timing is at best coincidental. And there was a hearing before the House Committee on Alcoholic Beverage Control this week looking at these exact same problems.
Are we alone in this or because, in other words, is there a COVID connection to this? Because there are shortages in everything right now and supply chain issues in everything right now. But South Carolina doesn't seem to be having this problem. Are other states having this problem or is it just us?
Well, the control state, other control states are having this problem. In Pennsylvania, I'm told they're rationing liquor, and limits on the amount of liquor you can buy at one time. And so, South Carolina, not a control state. You can walk into a private liquor store and go purchase your liquor of choice. North Carolina, Pennsylvania, control states, hard to find liquor.
Hmm. There's also a shortage, as you report this week, of beds for mental health patients in both North and South Carolina. Why?
This is a problem that has stretched for decades, and the issue affects both adults and children, but is particularly acute in children. In North Carolina, we have about 450 youth mental health beds. In South Carolina, they've got just over 600. Neither state has enough to meet the needs. Part of that is because the reimbursement rate for mental health treatment, actually hospitals lose money on that, is a money losing proposition. But as a result, Mike, mentally ill people in crisis, youth and adults, are being housed in emergency rooms for days or weeks at a time.
Wow. And for those questioning the impact of COVID, Mecklenburg County just announced it was getting an additional 5 ambulances and 10 crew members to help with the rising number of COVID calls. These vehicles and the crew members are coming from FEMA, and they'll be here for at least 10 days. I'm not sure why 10 days is the magic number or what happens after they leave, but the same thing is happening in Brunswick, Franklin, Graham, Guilford, Macon, New Hanover, Pender, and in Robson counties as well. So that should perk up some ears for people who say this is all imaginary and made up. Well, the liquor shortage must not be that bad, because when Mick Jagger was spotted sipping an adult beverage this week at the Thirsty Beaver Saloon, he was not singing this song. We know Mick was there because he posted a selfie on social media. Do we know how he came to be at the Thirsty Beaver in Plaza Midwood, or was he alone? Do we know?
I think he was just waiting on a friend.
Yeah, well, he needed that drink after driving around town and listening to a rebroadcast of this program. And here's what he had to say about that. No, wait a minute. He couldn't have been listening to this show. We have no useless information here. Must have been something else. He's evidently a man of eclectic taste, because the Thirsty Beaver is kind of a dive bar on Central Avenue, but he also reportedly had dinner at La Belle Hélène in Uptown in their private dining room, all in advance of the Rolling Stones concert at Bank of America Stadium last night, the first since the pandemic. Have we heard any reaction to what the fans saw last night there? None of you went. None of you could afford to go.
We Journalism, baby.
We know the crowd must have been huge, and this is the first of several COVID postponed and rescheduled concerts at BofA Stadium. Billy Joel, Elton John coming. So just want to thank Andos Helms, Jonathan Lowe, Nick Oxner, and Eric Spanberg for all the satisfaction you've given us this morning. Thank you all for the hour. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, pledging to help end child hunger in the Carolinas through ongoing support of Second Harvest Food Bank of Metrolina. Details about this initiative at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.